Welcome to the Design Thinker podcast, where we explore the theory and practice of design.
Hosted by me, Donnie, and
me, Peter.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to part two of our series on storytelling. In this episode, we talk about storytelling in organizations. Let's dive into the conversation.
Hey, Peter.
Hi, Danny. How are you?
Good.
Today, we're going to talk about storytelling and storytelling and stories, especially in relation to human-centered design, design thinking, of course. And then we thought we'd get even more focused and talk about storytelling in organizations. So,
in our previous episode, we talked about the stories we tell ourselves.
Yes.
So now we're talking about the stories that we tell in organizations.
And I think sometimes those can be similar, but sometimes and serve a similar purpose, but sometimes they can be slightly different stories and definitely serve a different purpose.
All right. So. Okay. What are we starting with?
Well, we usually start with a definition, don't we?
We do.
Go on. You're going to look up the dictionary?
Boop, 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 boop. So according to Google, storytelling, the activity of telling or writing stories, relating to the telling or writing of stories.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, here's a more nuanced one. Storytelling is the social and cultural activity of sharing stories, sometimes with the improvisation,
yeah,
theatrics, or embellishment.
Ooh.
I also love this. So it goes on to say, every culture has its own stories or narratives, which are shared as means of entertainment, education, cultural preservation, or instilling moral values.
Oh, wow.
I think that last bit is really important because we do that in organizations, right? So if you think about an organization as a culture, in every organization, there are stories. When we enter the organization, we hear stories. Actually, even before we enter the organization, we hear about them, which are stories. And then when we become part of an organization, we learn those stories, and then we become tellers of those stories.
Mm-hmm. I don't think we're going to go into myths and legends today. Maybe we will, but yeah, some of those, yeah, you hear stories about, you remind me, actually, before I joined one organization, I heard stories about these amazing Christmas parties that they used to, the story that they threw. They were kind of infamous and had infamous elements to the Christmas stories, and everybody talked about them, from the people that got me interested in working for the organization to the people involved in the recruitment process. So there's this big kind of story around that those parties, and they were a kind of signifier of the culture. It was only after I joined that people started to, I guess, reveal to me that, or I realized that that was a past story. It was actually history, and the Christmas parties weren't quite as infamous. They'd had to be toned down because they were slightly out of control. So, I was slightly disappointed, but also understood. I was also very sure to, whenever I spoke to anybody who might be joining the organization, to let them know that the Christmas party stories were great stories, but they were definitely a representation of what used to happen, not what currently happens. So don't join the organization purely on the basis of thinking you're going to have some wild party once a year.
I think that's a great example of sometimes storytelling helps keep legacy going.
Yeah, nice. Yeah.
And we do that as humans, right? We, like, even if you think about your family context, there's, when you get together as a family, there's always a story about great grandpa,
yeah,
Bob, who did something that, and, at this point, it's so many generations removed.
Mm-hmm.
We don't even know if it's a true story anymore, but we tell the story.
So why do you think we we tell those stories, what is it about those stories that that kind of makes us retell them or share them?
As humans, storytelling is so much a part of our being.
Yeah.
I think, you know, whether it's a family context or, you know, or work context, part of what storytelling does is it helps us remember that we're part of something bigger. It's also how we, like, I think the storytelling process helps share, like, who we are, where we've come from, or what is, I can't figure out a different way to say this, but, like, what is our story? Like, it's something that we're really curious about. Like, if you think about it, when you meet somebody new, you're curious, right? Like, what's their story? What's their deal? What, you know, where do they come from? What do they do? What are their interests? What are their motivations? Like, those are just things that our brains naturally want to know about.
Yeah, where are you from? Wondering. Like you said, we want to know who they are. We want to probably deep down establish really early on, is this a friend or foe? Is it somebody we can trust? Is it somebody we have something in common with, or is it somebody we have nothing in common with but perhaps we can learn from? Yeah, all of that stuff. When we come back to them, I'm interested in what stories kind of do to our brain. And why, you know, what is it about the wiring of our brain that makes, well, two things, stories so appealing, and also what is it that we can learn from that to make our stories appealing when we're telling them, not just when we're listening to them, reading them, experiencing them.
Oh yeah, this is such a, I love that. I love where you're going with this.
Okay.
The brain is my favorite organ. There's research that shows so when we tell stories or we listen to stories, there is an actual chemical reaction that happens. We know that when we tell and share stories, we create bonding relationships with people. Like, our brains release chemicals that,
yeah, okay.
So I think we've talked here about the feel-good hormones.
Yeah.
So the feel-good hormones, dopamine, serotonin, endorphins, and oxytocin.
Oxytocin, yeah. So I'll try not to say OxyContin, because that's oxytocin. That's,
yeah, I don't think either one of us are qualified to talk about oxytocin. No.
Moving on. So dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin.
No. yeah, dopamine, serotonin, endorphins, and oxytocin.
Thanks.
We know from research that when we engage in storytelling, our brains, sorry, not only when we engage in storytelling, but even when we're listening to stories, it releases these hormones. When we hear stories about somebody, it kind of endears us to them. It helps us bond with them. From a human perspective, who we are, we use stories as ways of connecting with people, as ways of building relationships. That's why we do it. The fact that there's a physical brain reaction, a chemical brain reaction to storytelling, also shows, like, how much it's part of our experience as humans. The other kind of line of thinking that I often think about is stories are also a big part of how we learn about the world. So if you think about our first experiences of stories is really when we're little children, right? Like, one of the first things that we experience are little storybooks. And also, if you think about that, like, in a cultural context, there are a set of storybooks that everybody sort of reads. Like, I remember in my childhood, Dr. Seuss books were really big.
Right. Yeah.
We all read them, we all know about them, and it kind of gets to be this thing that gets passed around. And I'm sure in other cultures, while I'm not familiar with them, I'm sure every culture or even country has a set of books that or a set of stories that are just commonly shared with children.
Yeah, and maybe not necessarily written down stories either. They could be oral stories that are simply passed on by word of mouth. Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, these kind of, I don't know, cultural anchor points or, you know, touchstones that most people have got in common. Yeah. Wow. Okay. This conversation's expanding a lot more than I expected it to. Yeah, I love that idea about stories that they're the way we learn about the world, a fundamental part of our experience of being human. I guess that comes from having language, and I guess listening to stories or even reading stories. So when we're sitting down reading a good book, then we've got dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin, endorphins going through our brains during that kind of reading experience. And I love that that the thing you mentioned about that's kind of helps us remember that we're part of something bigger. And then something else picking up is that we actually go through a bonding experience with somebody if they're telling us a story, or we become endeared with that person as we're reading a story about them. Yeah, a lot of this makes sense in the context of storytelling in an organization, and specifically storytelling as part of our design process. Whereabouts are we in our structure, Danny? In our conversation structure, at least trying to do, we kind of, it's a good definition.
So we've got a definition. We've talked about why. I wonder if we need to talk a little bit about why storytelling is important, specifically in the context of design thinking, and then we move to how.
Or yes, maybe even if we, it can be beyond the context of just design thinking, why storytelling is important in organizations, and maybe specifically in organization, like how can it, well, maybe corporates or organizations where the focus has tended to be, let's say, on reports or spreadsheets, or basically non-storytelling ways of conveying information. Because all of the, a story, a report, a spreadsheet, and a story, they're all different ways of conveying information, aren't they? And different ways that might have emphasis on different parts of information. I suppose storytelling is important in an organization, because of the reasons you've just described. Like when we, I'm not sure about the neuroscience of Excel spreadsheets or reports, because often they don't include reference to people. But yeah, for me, the story is the way to remind everybody in the organization what the purpose is of, either the organization as a whole or the specific endeavor that we're kind of focusing on, and it bringing it into our design work. Then it's really one of the reasons we want to do it, is to really dial up the empathy, like talk about the piece of work that we're doing and helping everyone understand why we're doing it from, well, a human-centered point of view. So that who is the person, the group of people that we're designing for, and why should we care about them, I think is one good reason to incorporate storytelling into our work.
So a couple of things that came up for me when you talked about that. I think storytelling, I absolutely agree. Like when we use stories, it helps us remember why. Like, why are we doing this? What's the point? And I think it also reminds us that our work is always in service of somebody, right? Like, no matter what your job is in service of somebody else. That helps, that keeps us centered on the purpose of our work. And we also know from other research that purpose, people want to have a purpose for waking up in the morning, for why am I working so hard? Why am I, why do I thrust myself out of bed at whatever time, fight traffic to go somewhere, to sit at a desk, to like, why am I doing this? And having a strong purpose is a big motivator for productivity, for outcomes, for all kinds of things. Stories are fundamental to that. I also have a little bit of a different view when it comes to numbers and stories. Like, so before I learned about qualitative research, which I know is a lot, I was actually a quantitative researcher. And my fascination with data, with quantitative data, which is very numbers heavy, it's always that I felt like there's a story in the numbers. Numbers are trying to tell us a story, and our job is to really look at that and pull out the story it's telling us. Even in the numbers, there is a story. So that was my second thought. And then I also think that stories is also what makes our work interesting. when we hear about how something we've done impacts a customer or makes a customer's life better, there's a feel-good response to that.
Yes, and probably involving some of the brain chemicals you mentioned earlier. Nice. I'm gonna we'll get into the discussion here about this the story and the numbers, because I wasn't a quantitative or qualitative researcher at any point, but I describe myself as a I used to be a spreadsheet jockey, so I used to work with the data and numbers. And I wonder, so I totally I understand what you mean, and I get what you mean, and there is a story in the numbers, but unlike, and maybe this is what to down to our individual mental models of what you know of a story. So let's say one example of a story is a book we're reading, or you know, a story we might actually be telling each other, or a film we're watching, etc. That the kind of the story is embodied in the medium, if that makes sense, versus when we look at a set of numbers, then there's a next there's a, at least one extra step to do to go from that set of numbers to creating the story about or that's contained within that set of numbers. Does that make sense? What do you think of that?
There's two things that are going through my head when you say that, because one is it's very easy to use numbers to tell the story we want to tell. So how do we make sure we're telling the story that the numbers are actually telling and not the story we want to tell? That's where my head is going when you were talking about that. Yes, that's kind of where my brain got stuck.
I guess what I was saying was I see the numbers are the in this case the numbers are the source of the story rather than the story itself. I bet this is one of these things where it seems like we might be disagreeing, but actually agreeing. Maybe
I
what I'm
think,
thinking,
yeah,
that
sorry.
no, I just that maybe, and this maybe this is a good example of actually in the workplace we're kind of surrounded by stories, but they're not obvious, and we don't pay enough attention, and there isn't enough time and effort invested in organizations generally, not enough emphasis placed on taking some raw data, or even some raw data that's been converted into charts, and then taking that to the next step or the step after that to turn it into a rich and compelling story. And what's also coming to my mind is that there's a LinkedIn sort of meme that does the rounds every now and again. There's Lego bricks. So there's like I think six maybe pictures of different sets of Lego bricks, and there's what the first picture is a single brick, and that's a you know a piece of data. Then I'll skip to the end where basically somebody's built a house out of Lego bricks, and essentially that's the kind of the metaphor says that the first picture is a data point, and the last picture is a story built using that data.
Which is where my comment, like, how do we make sure we're telling the story that we, I think I skipped a middle step there, right? So data in its rawest form is like, it's like a dictionary, right? It's just a bunch of things that it ends, but we have to figure out what the story is and pull the story out. And how do we organize this information in a way that tells the story? And then my point was, we have to also make sure that when we tell that story, we're telling it in an authentic way.
Yeah, agrees. I agree. And
I think what you're saying is that the data provides us parts of the story, but we still have to create the story or.
exactly. It's not the story itself. Just like if you don't mind me doing this, like right now we're looking at each other on Zoom. So, you know, there's Danny in her office. She has books on a shelf. You know, there's they're arranged in a different way. There's a couple of other ornaments there. There's a wall. There's a door. There's a window. There's a curtain. Those are all kind of elements of the story. You know, that aren't a story in themselves. Like you know, a one and a zero and a ten are elements in a data story, but they're not a story in themselves. Does that make sense? And I think often, maybe where we're getting to here is Yeah, again, in organizations, even in our design process, we need to put effort into putting those elements together to turn it into something that bringing it back to one of our starting points where other people can start to feel the dope flowing through their brains. Now, some people might get a buzz out of a one, a 10, and a zero, but if we turn it into something more interesting, then they will maybe more people will find what we're saying compelling. And I suppose in the context of our design process, what I think, storytelling is kind of central and fundamental to telling the story of our design process as we're going through it to help people understand where we are, where we've got to, and where we're going to. And those people are both are us as the team involved in the design process, the stakeholders, and of course the people that we might be designing for if they're not involved in our design process. Yeah, and I guess kind of jumping into the next maybe conversation topic, but I think there's a case for having stories being almost continuous, not just like, so I think some people think, well, let's leave the story to the end. We'll tell people where we started, where we went, and where we got to. I think it's actually, for me, when I kind of start to understand some simple storytelling techniques and really combine them with our design process, then the power is helping people early on understand or feel compelled to act because of the story that you tell them. And the best stories that compel people to act involve other people, don't they? Like what you said, like how do we help people in an organization that is full of data and information, and people are overwhelmed by, massive amounts of information flying their way every day? How do you create and tell a story that gets people's attention for the right reason in the right way and helps them dedicate their time, even if it's a small amount, or in the case of a stakeholder, prioritize the problem you've discovered and provide you with budget.
Yeah, I think so. I guess I'll illustrate this by telling a story. So, in a past life, one of the things that I did was I worked in the regulatory change space, using things like design thinking, human-centered design, in that realm. And one of the challenges that so. There's lots of regulations around privacy and data breaches, and lots of regulations and fines that organizations are hit with when there is a data breach. However, and companies have invested lots of money in terms of technology solutions and QA processes and all of these things. Number one reason, or one of the biggest causes of data breaches is human error. And one of the most effective, and the thing is, you tell people, look, you have to make sure you're not contributing to a data breach because we're going to get fined. You tell them all of these things. And where I've seen it, and it really doesn't, it's not that people are just being, dismissive about it. People get that it's serious. People understand it, but there's lots of things happening, and these things happen. Where I've seen the needle really shift and people's mindset about it really change is when they've heard stories about people, individuals that have been impacted by a data breach. The specificity of that story. So it cannot be 10,000 people were impacted. When it is Grandma Sue, whose identity was stolen, and it impacted all of these things in her life and what misery she went through for X many years trying to get all of that cleaned up. It's those stories that stuck with people. It's those stories that made people slow down a little bit and go, hang on, Am I sending this to the right person? Am I? So that is an example I like to share because people won't remember the fine that their company's going to get if there's a data breach, but they will remember how Grandma Sue's life was ripped apart because of a data breach.
Yeah, because and is that because, let's say, a fine is quite abstract and often, you know, if it's involving a corporation and a regulator, then the amount of the fine's probably going to be verging on the limits of our kind of comprehension to understand, you know, to imagine that amount of money that some of us may never see in our lives, versus so from the abstract kind of fine to the really relatable situation that you know, in this case Grandma Sue might find themselves in. You know, it's from the we can definitely empathize with Grandma Sue versus kind of empathizing with the abstract corporation paying the abstract fine. Is it's more difficult, is it? Do you think that's one of the reasons that
I think it's the abstraction of it. I also think you know, this concept in behavioral science, where, you know, how like if there's a fundraiser drive and it's like, oh, you know, save all the puppies in a pound, and which is not as effective as here's Fido and here's Fido's story.
Yeah,
it's like when there's a specific story, our brains can bond with that character. To going back to Grandma Sue, most of us have a grandma or had a grandma or have a parent that's elderly, and we can relate to, oh my God, this could happen to my grandma. This could happen to my mother. This could happen to me. That's why.
Because, well, yeah, fundamentally people care about people. So
But also when there's a specific person or character, there's like a specific example, right? Like our brains like concreteness. It doesn't like the ambiguity.
Yeah.
So that specific case.
Go ahead.
It's the same reason why personas are effective, right?
Okay. Because
personas help us narrow down. Like you can go from talking about a customer. Like if I say to you a customer, your brain is like, well, what customer? What do they do? What's their name? Like your brain is trying to piece together. And the more ambiguous that person is, the less you care about it.
Mm-hmm. So specific and about an individual, not about a large kind of undefined group of people or nameless group of people.
But stories have specific people in them, right? Like if you think about your favorite story from childhood, there's a specific character.
The first book that came to mind or story was Danny, Champion of the World by Roald Dahl. I'm thinking maybe you could have a game, can you, where you change the title of books to make them a lot less interesting and appealing. So Danny, Champion of the World, you go school kids between the age of 9 and 10 who live in the countryside. Doesn't quite work as
not
well.
Not as
it?
Appealing.
Whereas Danny, who's Danny? What's Danny all about? Okay, nice. So yeah, we're starting to get into some ingredients of good, compelling stories. And I suppose, you know, the purpose of the stories we're telling, and you know, your example of regulation, we telling stories, we want them to result in action, don't we? We want something to happen as a result of the stories we're telling. What are some other ingredients of a good story?
I don't think that randomly telling stories is going to drive action.
Yeah, okay.
So I think we also have to be very purposeful about where we place our stories. In the example of the data breaches, when those stories of people that were impacted were shared, it was in the context of we have a part to play in protecting our customers' information. And when we don't do that, here's what happens. Whereas if we just randomly went around and talked about, oh, this is what happened to Grandma Sue, I don't know that it would have had the same impact. We really need to do an episode on context because I feel like it comes up in every episode.
Quite,
So
yeah.
the context in which you are telling the story is important because story has to align to context. Otherwise, it's just random.
That's a great point. When I think of I guess successful, not necessarily stories, but successful storytelling that I've been part of, then has never been, as you mischievously indicate, it's not you're kind of walking down the corridor at work or in the lunchroom or you're at your desk and all of a sudden you stand up and say, "Hey everyone, I've got this story to tell you." Or even if you're to do a song and dance routine, I mean, it could be memorable. Let's face it, if you do a "Grandma Sue was struck by poverty all because of us. It was our fault. We didn't pay attention to the fine print."
Pete's singing and dancing routines are available for hire.
Yeah, anytime. Yes, I think I mean, that might be entertaining and get you somewhere, probably out of the door. But the efforts that I've been involved in that have been successful, there's actually quite a lot of free work. So, in complete contrast to that song and dance routine where you spontaneously burst into it, actually warming people up to the fact that they are going to be invited to a session where they will hear some stories and here's the purpose of the stories, and having people step into that session in the right frame of mind to receive stories, I think those are just as important, if not more so, than the actual story and the structure of the story themselves, I think. I mean, yeah, but maybe if we think about, I think having people's expectations set up, and then creating the right environment for people to be receptive to the stories they're going to hear is super important.
So I think we said so character is important. Context is important. Your story's got to have an arc, right? It's got to have a beginning, a peak, it's the middle, and then some sort of ending. The shorter that you can make the shorter you can make the start, the peak, and the end, the more impactful your story is. And it's not a science because you don't and it's not really about the speed, right? Because you want to provide enough detail that it's interesting. But you also don't want to drone on for so long.
Why did you look at me like that? Yeah, go on.
You don't want to drone on. What I was going to say is, everyone's has that family member that tells a story. And when they start telling a story, like you just know, all right, I'm going to have to settle in.
Yeah. Top my drink up, please.
Yeah. So you don't want to do that, but you also don't want to tell a story that's so void of detail that people are like, what? What was the point of that? So it's that balance between right amount of detail and you're telling it at a pace that keeps people interesting. And sometimes, and this comes back to context, right? So you might have one story that you use for different things. And you might need to edit your story depending on the context that you're telling it. Because in some audiences, some details might be more important than others, and vice versa, right? So you kind of have to be mindful. And I guess this is the other point, is in addition to the context, you also have to be mindful of your audience.
Yeah, probably. Is that number one? Like, know your audience?
Yeah, oh, I wasn't doing these in any order.
No.
Just kind of how they're popping up.
Sure. No, I mean, yeah, me neither. But I'm just reminded, as you said, I'm re being reminded of lessons I've learned in the past. And, whether you're, however you're telling your story, like, knowing your audience is, it's probably the most important, like, knowing as much as you can about your audience. Some of the stuff I mentioned before about warming them up, and different people will need, some people you can say, "Hey, come to this session in 5 minutes," and they'll be fine, versus other people you might need to, give them, lots of pre-read 2 weeks ahead of time to get them to get into the right mindset to hear the story you're going to, and probably jumping ahead, not just hear the story, but actually have them take the action that you really like them to take as a result of hearing your story.
Even thinking about where you place the story, right? Sometimes, so let's say you're doing a presentation or a training, or let's say you're doing a presentation on something. Sometimes, depending on the audience, the context, it might make sense to start with a story. Sometimes, again, depending on the audience and the context, you might need to start with some facts. The facts are, in the past year, we've had X number of data breaches. And it's cost us X amount of dollars. Or it might be, I'm going to start this off by telling you about Grandma Sue. I don't know where that sits in terms of like context, audience, and where in the big picture of what you're doing, where do you place the stories?
Yeah, me neither, but I think that what we're saying is think about it. Like there isn't, like you're saying, there's, I don't think I agree that it's not a science. There is some science involved in understanding why great stories are great stories, perhaps, but I think the creation and telling of a great story is maybe a balance of art and science, but certainly more, for me anyway, more emphasis on art than science. The art of a great story and the art of great storytelling.
One thing we can also do better is, you know, as you're thinking about the storytelling, put yourself in the shoes of the person that's hearing the story, because it'll help you think about how to structure it, where the placement is, what details are important, what details aren't important.
Nice. Yeah, which goes back to your point earlier about the edit the story. You might probably want to edit the story in a different way for different audiences. You know, a certain group of a certain audience might want the kind of headline story. Other groups might want all of the details, you know.
What now?
Well, now, well, we've got a little bit of time to go into some of the specific how. Maybe a couple of storytelling frameworks. I like to use a framework in storytelling. Just a, it doesn't matter what the framework is usually, but starting off with a framework and using it for me helps me hit that sweet spot of the right amount of information. Just concise enough to get it across. Otherwise, I'm at risk of being the boring uncle at the party.
I think frameworks are, and we've said this before, right? Frameworks and models, they're all flawed, they're all broken, but they're also useful. So I think it's also, and before we talk about some frameworks, I think it's also important to say that your framework should be a guide. You shouldn't be so committed to the framework that you forget what you're doing, right? Like, because otherwise it becomes a tick the box exercise. And on the other end, you shouldn't abandon a framework altogether, because then you end up being the uncle that tells the long, boring stories that you're not at. So this, again, that balance of, getting it in the middle.
And sorry, maybe just to, slightly facetious about being the long boring uncle, but I find in the work and organization company context, when we're telling a story, that one of the pitfalls we can fall into is, especially if we're, let's say, telling a story to some stakeholders or to people who, have a bit of power in the organization, we can find ourselves falling into the pitfall of justification, I think of it as. We can and that leads us to provide lots of embellishment and detail, and the story starts to lose its impact because we haven't just kind of let the story tell itself.
The way I like to think about it is, you tell the story, you let the story have the impact, and let the questions come later. That should be where you provide the details. So if you think about it as a commercial, like think about some of the most effective commercials that you've ever watched or seen. They don't provide all the nitty-gritty details. They tell a story that gets you interested. And then when you're interested, you might go Google it. Or you might go to the store and look at it. But they don't tell you like the measurements, like the nitty-gritty details of the thing, right? They tell a story that gets you interested, and then once you're interested, then you go and ask questions.
Yeah, nice.
Okay, so storytelling frameworks. The basic framework is simply a story has to have a beginning, middle, and an end. And in the beginning, you need is where you're setting the story up. So this is where who's the character and some details that help us understand the character, and then you take them on this journey, and then there's got and then it gets to a peak. So this is usually conflict or something. And then when you come down the peak, that's when the resolution starts, right? And then you end, it has to come to some sort of conclusion. So at a very basic level, that is a storytelling framework. Now, there's other ones, and I think, Pete, there's a couple that you're a big fan of, so I'll let you talk to those.
Okay. Yeah, the nice anchoring in the very, very basic, yeah, beginning and middle end. So there's like a situation, there's a conflict or complication, and then the end is the resolution. That's the bit that it's like the payoff where we our brains get that kind of satisfaction from the circle being closed or the problem being solved in our case. Yeah, a couple of the we're getting really specific, I guess, on into our design, human-centered design approach. I guess probably the first storytelling framework I got introduced to and started using on a reasonable regular basis. I think it comes from the D school and the Stanford D school originally, but probably precedes that. But that framework of let's imagine we've been doing some research and we've met some people and we've gathered some insights and gained some insights and we actually started to create some ideas. Well, the framework is first of all describe who we met. So we met and we might describe the person or a couple of people. We might describe their situation and we'll describe it in such a way that we know that it's going to have people care about, like our audience, I should say, care about the people that we met. So we met, and then this phrase, we were amazed to realize. So we met so and so, we were amazed to realize something about something in their lives. And amazed is the right word to use because often we set off to research something and discover something completely different. And this amazed to realize, the surprise, it's like the hook in the beginning of the story that gets people's attention because you go, oh, that's interesting. I wonder why that happened. And then the next stage of the story, so we met, we were amazed to realize. And then the next stage of our design story is it would be game changing if. So I like this phrase, it would be game changing because what is compelling, if we're setting this framework even up before we even start our design work and we're aiming to create something, might not be game changing in itself, but it would be game changing if it was part of this person's life. So it would be game changing if. And insert any number of different ideas, whether it's a physical product or a service or just a conversation, but a game changing if. And often that's where the story is left because I think as I hinted at, I like to introduce storytelling into our design process, thread it through, don't have it, at the end. So we might have done our research, we might have found something really important in somebody's life to try and help them solve, and we've come up with some ideas. So that's an early, this like three stage story or 3 point story is a really great way to get people to, I guess, come on the journey with you. You might have been a small team doing some research in your spare time because you think there might be an opportunity for the organization to improve something for customers or for team members, and this like three stage story is a really great way to go. Hey everyone, there's a problem over there. Your opportunity over here. It's affecting people's work lives or daily lives or broader. We've got a couple of ideas. Come and help us. And then as we maybe kind of fast forwarding further through the design process, we might elaborate on that story. So we met so and so. We were amazed to realize so something. We thought it'd be game changing to do X. The next stage of the story is so what we built was, and then you built a prototype of X, and the next stage in the stories, and we tested X with our potential users or customers, and what we learned was, and we tell the story of the feedback we got by testing the prototype of X, and then the kind of culmination of the story at this stage is what we're going to do next is, and it could be X, it could be throw X in the bin and start again, or it could be nothing, but yeah, that's a particular story framework that I think is useful during a design process, and from my experience, seems to get people's attention the right way. And also, I think of it as kind of keeps the conversation at the right level, because we're talking about the human-centered, first of all, problem or opportunity, and then we're talking about the human-centered solution. And also, probably most importantly, from an organization point of view, it keeps things kind of focused on the person that we're designing for, because in that story, we're not saying specifically how we're going to build something, scale something, specifically how much it's going to cost. We're really keeping it at the here's the problem from a human point of view, here's the solution. And within that story, there should be enough reason to, for people to get interested at least. And as you were saying, keep it short and snappy, get the questions, and then from the questions comes the detail, because to back up that story and make it help people sign up to helping you in that the next stage of the journey, then you should have all the detail about, how might we do this? How much is it going to cost? What's it going to take? So that's one. Do you want me to recap it?
Well, I was trying to think about, I've got so many things going through my head. So the reason I love that format is it's something that you can use throughout the process. And I actually think it's something we can use. Look, in every organization, we have to do reporting. We've got to give updates on what we're doing, And I think this format really gives us a way to be able to include storytelling in our reporting. The starting of a project could be we met with, and we were surprised to learn. So we met with Grandma Sue. We were surprised to learn that she lost her house because of a data breach. We thought it would be amazing to something. So we decided
Buy our
to
house back for
go. So we thought it would be amazing to go do X. And you can use that in your reporting, right? So this is where we are at today. This is what we're going to go do next. And we'll come back to you and tell you how the story ends. And then you can put in all the other boring reporting things that none of us like to do but have to do because it's our jobs. But it's a way that we can incorporate storytelling into something that we already do as an organization.
Yeah, love it. You've hit the nail on the head there, Danny.
Okay, so now the second example I think you have of a storytelling framework.
Yeah, well, this one I'm not used quite as often, but I do like it. Again, it's compelling. It comes from or it's attributed at least to Pixar, and probably has similarities to other storytelling frameworks in Disney, for example. It's kind of like this. It begins with "Once upon a time," so something along the lines of "Once upon a time there was," and maybe it's there was a lady called Grandma Sue who lost her house. But once upon a time there was, every day, something's happening until one day, something happens. Because of that, something else happens. Because of that, something else happens until finally, the whole situation is resolved. Yeah, I've used that a few times. I think it kind of ticks the box of character, of having this kind of dramatic arc, and definitely lights up all the gives us all of our brain chemicals. But once upon a time, we're setting the stage every day, so we're describing the character's kind of daily routine. One day, there's something that kind of interrupts that routine. Because of that, gets the hero or the character back on track, and then ever since, kind of share the new normal until finally, and then it's like the climax of the story. So in the context of our design process and our research, we might find, once upon a time, this is all about what we've discovered in our design research. We're bringing to life in the everyday what this person is doing, what they're like, what they need to do. One day, something happens, and then because of that, you know, the kind of end of the story from our point of view might be, well, we designed something that solved the problem, and ever since they started using our solution, then their life is back on track or gets better. Yeah, something along those lines.
I find the that framework to be effective when we're getting into design work
Okay.
because I like to use it and then pause the story at the arc. Like, you know, they used to do this every single day, and then it got to a point where they couldn't, and then that kind of opens it up for us to go do the design work. And then it's a good way when we're once we've gone through the design work and we've gotten something out into the world, it's a good way to almost tell the story in retro, demonstrate how we can use design to solve the challenge.
That makes sense.
I also think here, you know, if there are some audiences that I wouldn't use that framework with that I might use the previous framework with. Right. So again, it comes back to even deciding how you're going to use the storytelling, which storytelling framework you're going to use. You still need to think about your audience.
That which where would you be cautious about using that framework? Or I was going to say, or in contrast, where do you find it to be the most effective?
When you use language like once upon a time, like if I was working with a very conservative, very strong structured, or a team or organization that's very new into design thinking, I wouldn't necessarily use that model because I think it would be too big of a leap. Right. And I think I wouldn't use that because it would be too big of a leap. And I think I would lose the audience if I began with Once Upon a Time. In contrast, if I took that same story to that same group of people and I started with, we met with, it's like a very factual, action-oriented.
Once upon a time is a bit, it's a bit more of a playful structure, and I suppose whoever your audience is, certainly in the Western English speaking world, like once upon a time, people will associate that with, yeah, fairy tales. I think generally. So yeah, I agree with you. Maybe the one kind of add to that is, unless actually you're aiming to really kind of interrupt their thinking pattern, and you're starting that, you know, sometimes a little bit of a contrast to what people might be expecting or what they've had up until then could be enough to get their attention right from the outset. But I think it's you're right to, I would be really cautious and have to think and, you know, plan, you know, way ahead to for that to work.
I think this is where, so think about it this way, right? So let's say you've got a 5-year-old child and you're picking a book for them. You're probably not going to pick out Shakespearean plays for them to read.
True.
You're probably going to start at something like a Dr. Seuss type book. One of the most important things to understand about storytelling is your story has to meet the audience where they are. If the gap between where they are and where they need to be from a creativity innovation point, you can't start at the height of something because people will just disconnect. So your story's got to start, your story has to be able to meet the audience where they are today. So your story has to meet the audience where they are today so that you can take them on this journey. If you want to use a story to jolt things up, then this comes back to context, then you've got to do something before that story so that something you're doing meets people where they are.
Yeah, that makes sense.
All right, so we've talked about what, why, how, and I think the next thing in our storytelling framework of this podcast is we talk about the design thinking capabilities that are recognizing that they all play a role in everything we do, but what are the What of the six design thinker capabilities are most relevant in storytelling?
Well, I think empathetic exploring, you know, both in your exploring your the characters that become part of your story or the and also your audience. Idea generation is important, and maybe kind of getting meta, what you're designing a story to tell to people. So, you know, your point about frameworks are just guides and don't treat them as, you know, tick lists. So, you know, think about the best way to tell a particular story for a particular audience that you've let you know, empathize with, then that takes some ideation. We haven't really talked about it, but you know, visual communication, I think, should be front of mind as well. You know, a great story, even though we're on a podcast, so you can't see us, but you know, great stories involve the right balance of. What do you think? What anything to add to that?
Absolutely, empathetic exploration for all of the things that we've talked about, right? It's about building connection, understanding people. I think visual communication, which is odd because our storytelling medium on this podcast is audio, but there is. So when we are telling stories, the visual, so visuals have a big, have a lot to do with our comprehension of a story, our remembering of a story. So being very mindful of how are we visually communicating and also being deliberate. On a podcast, there is an expectation. It's kind of universally understood. If I choose to listen to a podcast, it's going to be audio. Even though you and I sit here and talk and gesture with our hands, nobody's able to see. I'm curious to see collective collaboration because storytelling isn't a one-person act.
It's at the very least two, isn't it?
So that's the one that I'm.
It's interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's a good, yeah, good to highlight it because, yeah, we should be, yeah, in a way. So you're maybe empathetic exploration where you're seeking to understand, let's say, your audience, before you tell them the story, and then you could, in a way, you could say, you know, that the storytelling itself is actually a collective collaboration. It's a collaboration between the person telling the story and the person hearing, watching, listening to the story, sometimes in real time. Yeah, it's a good that's thought provoker that one actually.
Because one thing we didn't talk about is sometimes when we're telling the story, like I might have a story I'm telling, but in the process of telling that story, so let's say I'm saying telling you the story, Peter, and in the process of that, you're sharing some of your experiences, and now we're co-creating a third story. And that's often what this podcast is, right? There's like we talk about these things, and I have a view, you have a view, and then we put our views on the table, and then we create this third view that's this collective view.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, you've really got me thinking actually.
Want to mention before we move on is, you know, empathetic exploration isn't just when you're planning to tell your story. I think it's also in the process of telling the story. So right now, like I'm talking to you and I'm watching your body language. And I'm making eye contact, and those are giving me cues, right? So if I'm watching and you seem interested, then that gives me feedback like, okay, I've hit on some points.
Nice.
So there's also that, like we have to look at the audience, or which again, in a podcast situation, people could be using this podcast to fall asleep for all we know, hopefully not. But in most storytelling situations, we have to, those watching our audience and paying attention to their nonverbal cues is also part of empathetic exploration.
Yeah, I love that.
All right. I think we've covered this topic through our framework.
We've covered a lot. Nice one, Danny. What? Yeah, that was nice. We covered lots there. What were you going to take away from this one? What's something you're going to do?
I think what's inspired me hearing you talk about the two different frameworks is actually going out and looking at what are some other frameworks. I actually want to see if there's a framework that is embedded in behavioral science. Like, is there a framework that marries the brain activity of storytelling to how we tell a story? So that's my takeaway. How about you?
Can I add one more thing before we before I give you the takeaway? Just you've your thought there is I think you know, in fact, I'm sure I saw one of their books on your bookshelf, the Chip and Dan Heath, the Heath brothers.
Yep.
Like you've got Switch there in your book.
I've
Their
got all
first book.
four of them.
Oh yeah, well, their first book is called Made to Stick, everyone. And within Made to Stick, they actually have a model for telling stories that stick basically in people's minds, and it uses the acronym SUCCESS. Principle one is keeping it simple. Principle two is m making it unexpected. Principle two is making things concrete. Number four is having things be credible. Number five is emotional. And then finally, principle six is tell stories. And I remember reading this book a long time ago, but you don't have to tick every box there, but the more of those kind of principles that you can incorporate into the message you're telling or the story you're telling, the more chance you'll make these your stories, your messages memorable and sticky, and therefore the more chance people will take action on them. So, I guess that almost summarizes Grandma Sue versus Fiennes.
Love it. I totally forgot about that book. I do have it on
So,
my shelf.
yeah, it's at least 10 years old, maybe more actually. It's definitely more than 10 years old, just remembering where I bought it. But I bet there's behavioral science kind of incorporate. You can incorporate behavioral science into each of those principles. Anyway, what am I taking away from this? Maybe the opposite to you, actually. And I'm going to revisit and pay attention more to the kind of storytelling than the stories or story framework. You know, that thing about the audience and the context. Yeah, I'm going to dust down some of that thinking that I've done in the past and refresh.
Which kind of prompts for me another one is thinking about where can I use storytelling more?
Well, we'll have a joint one. Thanks for that gift. I'm going to think about that as well. You look for
Awesome.
opportunities to use it more. Yeah.
All
All right.
right. I think that does it for us for this episode. It
I
was a
think
great
so.
chat, Peter. Thank you.
Yeah. Same to you, Danny. Thanks very much. And thanks for listening.
See you next time. Bye.
Bye.